That's it.
All right.
Okay, we come to the concluding part of our current section, chapters 1 and 6, mostly chapter 6. And the context is important, so let me remind you. Yudhishthira sees Bhishma lying near death, and Yudhishthira is racked with guilt. He feels personally responsible for Bhishma's impending death. Bhishma explains that it's more complicated. It's not just Yudhishthira. He's one of many, many factors involved in leading up to his death. And Bhishma begins to tell Yudhishthira about how karma works, how there are many factors. And to explain that more thoroughly, Bhishma quotes a story in which Brahmaji teaches the doctrine of karma to the sage Vasishtha. So what we're actually seeing here are verses in a dialogue between Brahma and Vasishtha, typical story inside a story inside a story. That's what we see here as well. Excuse me, just a moment. All right. In the context of explaining the doctrine of karma, we saw this unique metaphor given. I mentioned in the meditation session, I haven't seen this metaphor anywhere else. We all know that the two main factors involved are daiva, and the term used in this chapter is purushakara. It says that the two factors responsible for the outcome of any situation is your actions, your willful actions, your effort, but not just your effort and actions, but also daiva refers to that which comes from deva, God, which means karma pala, the results of past actions. So current actions and the results of past actions, which we loosely call karma, determine the outcome of any situation. You know this well, but what's unique here is we see this metaphor wherein daiva is represented by seeds, and I'm going to expand on this in just a moment, and purushakara is represented by land. So this is a metaphor of a farmer who, in order to produce crops, can he produce crops with seeds alone or land alone? No, he requires both, seed and land. And that's to illustrate how the outcome of a situation is not due purely to your effort, purushakara, nor is it due purely to daiva, the results of past karmas. It is the combination of the two factors. This is fundamental to the doctrine of karma. And how nicely it's illustrated here with this metaphor. So the result of a past karma is waiting to fructify. Just like there is a plant inside a seed waiting to sprout, in the same way, these past actions are like seeds. The results are pending. They're waiting to emerge, waiting to fructify. So seed is a perfect metaphor for the results of our past actions, karma, here called daiva. And then land brilliantly shows the other necessary factor. And now we can go a little bit further with this. Suppose the farmer puts a lot of effort into the land, irrigating it, tilling it, getting rid of the weeds, more crops, right? Suppose the farmer does the opposite. Just plant, throws the seeds on the ground, and then comes back in 6 months and see what happens. Well, you can imagine that the crop won't be very good in that case. What that shows is the importance of purushakara, and you can't just depend on Daiva. And conversely, we didn't see this before, and it's actually not mentioned here, but it's nice to extend this. Actually, we saw in maybe two classes ago different kinds of seeds. Some seeds are very robust and give rise to strong plants. Some seeds are weak and give rise to weak plants. I'm going to take it one step further. Suppose some of those seeds are not seeds for rice or wheat. Suppose they're the seeds for common weeds all mixed in there. So you plant those seeds for weeds, and of course what emerges is weeds, which are undesirable because they crowd out the other crops. That's a good metaphor for papa karma, the results of our past bad actions, harmful actions. They fructify in our lives in an undesirable way. Like seeds can fructify as undesirable weeds, in the same way our past harmful actions can fructify in ways that are undesirable to us. So very, very nice metaphor. We've seen this in some detail. And now we'll come to the final part of this chapter. In the final part of this chapter, we get some examples. And before we see the examples, I just want to make an important observation here. Given the fact that there are two factors, sometimes people will overemphasize one factor and de-emphasize the other. Amongst modern educated scientific people, there might be a tendency to devalue or de-emphasize the importance of Daiva, but Daiva is a fact. You know, I find it amazing. An excellent example of in medical science, surgeons, surgeons of Indian origin, in particular Hindu surgeons, almost all say almost exactly the same words, and that is, they go into the operating theater, they do the best they can, but the outcome is not in their hands. Every Hindu surgeon will say those exact words, because those Hindu surgeons recognize the fact that Daiva is present in every situation. The non-Hindu surgeons will say something similar, and they'll put it in the language of science. And they say, according to statistics, 60% of this surgery turn out to be successful. 40% end in death of the patient. And, you know, they're saying almost the same thing, but instead of attributing it to Daiva, they're putting it in scientific language of statistics and randomness and percentages. So it's true, though, that many might want to devalue or de-emphasize Daiva. And that would be a mistake. On the other hand, the audience for this Mahabharata are not scientifically minded people. The audience is going to be Hindus, by and large. Hindus who are, what? Listen to this. Hindus which might be overly inclined to emphasize Daiva and to de-emphasize Purushakara. The opposite of those scientific-minded people, these pious Hindus would make the opposite mistake, and that is to depreciate the value of their own efforts. And how many times have you heard this? Kya karenge? You've heard that thousands of times. What can be done? Sab kuch Bhagavan ki haath mein hai. Sorry if my Hindi is a little rough, but you get the idea. Everything is in God's hands. Wait a minute. That's not at all what what the doctrine of karma teaches, but you get the point that many Hindus are likely to err on that side, on the side of emphasizing daiva and de-emphasizing purushakara. Both are factors. If we're going to be wise and live a good life, we better be ready to fully acknowledge both of these points. But since there's a tendency to emphasize daiva over purushakara, you're going to see that the two examples given here, these are examples given by Brahmaji as he's teaching the sage Vasishta, both of these examples shift the emphasis back to purushakara, which is to say both factors are present, but here we're going to see emphasis on purushakara for the sake of kind of correcting this attitude problem where we overemphasize daiva and de-emphasize purushakara. Let's see the two verses now. And these are two examples. Pandavanam hritam rajam, Pandavanam hritam rajam, Dhartarashtrair mahabalaihi, Dhartarashtrair maha, Punah pratyahritam chaiva, Punah pratyahritam, Nadhaivad bhujasam shrayat, Nadhaivad bhujasam. Pandavanam rajam hritam. The raja, the kingdom, Pandavanam, of the Pandavas, was hrita. It was robbed away by whom? Dhritarashtraihi, by the sons of Dhritarashtra, especially Duryodhana. And these, they were able to, the Kauravas were able to rob away the kingdom. Why? Because they are mahabalaihi. They were very powerful. Not powerful, physically powerful they were, but they were very powerful in their use of deception, right? You all know the story, and we're not going to recount the whole story, but remember Shakuni in a dice game and everything else. So through this powerful use of deception, the Kauravas were able to rob away the kingdom from the Pandavas. Now, when the Pandavas lost their kingdom, what was their response? Did they say, oh, we lost our kingdom, we must have really bad karma? They didn't say that. One could say that. If you were to wrongly emphasize daiva, you lost your kingdom, and you say, yeah, it must be God's will, it's daiva, it's all past karma, whatever it is. And that would be a terrible mistake. If your car gets stolen, are you going to say it's bad karma? Bad pun, right? Karma. Sorry about that. Unintentional. Karma. Something. And if you argue, wait a minute, Swamiji, couldn't it be so? Couldn't it be that the bad things that happen to us in life are due to our own bad karmas? Bad things intentionally done by others, listen carefully, bad things intentionally, deliberately done by others is not your bad karma. It's due to their deliberate action. We said there are two factors, daiva and purushakara. Purushakara is the willful effort done, not merely the willful effort done by you. Could be the willful effort done by others. Do you get it? So the willful effort of some thief who stole your car, that's why you lost your car, not because of bad karma. The willful effort of the Kauravas to rob away the kingdom, that's what led to the loss of the kingdom, not bad karma. If we make a mistake here, we cause a horrible corruption to the doctrine of karma. And it does get corrupted. Look at this. Here's the extension of the argument. On the terrible terrorist attack of 9/11, 3,000 people died. Suppose you were to say it was there, so many people were in the Twin Towers, so many people were not in. You hear so many stories. Somebody who's late for work, etc. Or someone who had an unusual appointment to go there and lost their lives. So people, based on this, then they try to put a karmic spin on that story, if I can use that language. And here's the result of that karmic spin, which is wrong. The result of that karmic spin is this. 3,000 people had so much bad karma that they were destined to die on that day. Absurd. Absolutely absurd. Their karma was probably to live long, happy, productive lives. Their lives were cut short by the terrible act of those terrorists. Purushakara, not Daiva, Purushakara. And another extreme example of this, I'm giving you these extreme examples so you won't forget. And here's the other one you won't forget. 6 million Jews were executed during World War II. Bad karma. Absolutely not. This is the terrible deeds of an entire regime, this Nazi regime. So what a horrible thing to imply that it was their karma to die, to be executed, to be gassed to death and then incinerated in ovens. Horrible to imply that it was their karma. It was an abuse of free will. It was Purushakara and not Daiva. So we're very clear. Here in this verse, the same point is being made that the robbing away of the Pandavas' kingdom was not due to their karma. It was due to Purushakara. It was due to the willful actions of the Kauravas. Then what happened? Punaha. And then Pratyahritam cha eva. The kingdom was pratyahritam, was taken back, was regained by the Pandavas. How did the Pandavas regain the kingdom? Na daivat. Not due to good karma. The Pandavas were successful. The Pandavas were victorious on the battlefield because of their good karma or because of their good fighting? The latter, right? So the Pandavas were successful on the battlefield. Of course, they did have good karma. But the verse says, na daivat. Not because they had good karma were they victorious, but rather, bhuja, samshrayat. Makes it very clear. Samshrayat, dependency on your bhuja, on your arms, meaning your physical strength. So the Pandavas were successful in regaining control over their kingdom, not daivat, not due to daiva, but rather bhuja samshrayat, due to their prowess on the battlefield, due to their purushakara. So this is the first of two examples. Please note how the example puts emphasis on purushakara, not that daiva doesn't exist, but since we are likely to de-emphasize Purushakara, this verse makes us recognize the importance of Purushakara. One more example is given, very different. Tapo niyamasam yukta, tapo niyamasam munaya samshrita vrataha, munaya samshrita vrataha. Kim te daiva bala chapam, kim te daiva bala chap, utsrijante na karmana, utsrijante na karmana. Start in the second line. Munayaha, munis, sages. Sages who are samshita vrataha, who are completely committed to their life of austerities. In fact, that's what it says in the first one, first line. Tapas niyama samyuktaha. They are samyuktaha. They are endowed with niyama. They follow dharma. And they're endowed with tapas. Tapas austerities, these religious austerities, fasting, etc. Or you've seen the pictures of the prototypical muni standing on one leg with his hands over his arms. And the story would tell you how that muni has been standing like that for 1,000 years. Yeah, well, how can he stand like that for one? It's a story. But here's the point. As a result, and according to the stories, as a result of the intensity of that tapas, these munis, muni means sage, these sages were endowed with certain powers, siddhis, as a result of their intense spiritual practice. And one of the siddhis that the sages are said to have been endowed with as a result of their intense penance, they're endowed with the siddhi, the power of shapa. Shapa means giving a curse. And by the way, a curse that actually does something. When you curse someone, it doesn't do anything. Does that give you a bad reputation? The story is, in the stories, when the sage casts a shapa, a curse on someone, it has very real power. Stories. But now, an analysis of those stories is in the second half of the verse. Kim te daiva balat shapam utsrajante. Shapam, the curse, utsrajante, they cast those curses. They produce those curses, they make their curses, those sages make their curses. Kim daiva balat, are there curses? Kim, question mark, are they due to daiva balat, the power of daiva? Are they due to their good karmas? Or na karmana, is the power that they have to curse people, na karmana, is it not due to the intense tapas they performed? You see the point that's being made here, and it uses a typical... We do the same thing in English. We call it rhetorical questions. When somebody says, aren't you getting... Sorry for my American English. Aren't you going to get up and do something? Should you reply to that question? It's a rhetorical question. The question is to make a point. What is a point? You're lazy. So here we find questions, but the questions are not really questions. The questions are making a point. And the point is about the curses that those rishis, the sages, are able to make. Kim, daiva balat, are those curses due to daiva, their good karma? Na karmana, and not due to the intense tapas they've done for so long. Very clearly, their power to cast curses is a result of their purushakara. True, these rishis have lots of punya. They have lots of good karma, daiva. But their ability to cast curses is the direct result, not of daiva, it's a direct result of purushakara, their intense austerities, their spiritual practices. So the second example, putting the emphasis on purushakara, as I said, to correct our tendency to de-emphasize purushakara. Now, we move on to more metaphors. We've already seen the metaphor of the seeds and land. Now, in the next two verses, we get two new metaphors showing the interrelationship or the mutual dependency of Daiva and Purushakara. So instead of the seed and land metaphor, we get two other metaphors. Yathagnih pavano dhutaha, yathagnih pavano dhu sukshmo pi bhavate mahan, sukshmo pi bhavate tatha karma samayuktam, tatha karma daivam sadhu vivardhate, daivam sadhu vivardhate. Yatha, a typical way of introducing a metaphor, just as yatha agnihi, just as fire. Fire, in the second line, sukshmaha api. Even though that fire might start off being very small, sukshma here means small. So just as agnihi, a fire, sukshmaha api, which is very small, bhavate mahan, it becomes large. It becomes a huge blaze. How does that little fire become a huge blaze? He explains, pavana udhutaha. Udhutaha, fanned, pavana, by the wind. So that little fire, when fanned by the wind, becomes big. Notice it's showing two factors. One factor is the fire, the other factor is the wind. That fire would not become big without the wind, and also the wind wouldn't make a big fire without the little fire. So the combination of these two factors, a little fire plus the fanning of wind, gives rise to a big blazing fire. So this is a metaphor. The darshtanta, the other part of the metaphor, is introduced by tatha. For our Sanskrit students, how typical that is. Yatha, just as, blah, 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 blah. Tatha, in the same way, blah, blah, blah. This is a very typical Sanskrit sentence structure. So just as fire, when fanned by the wind, becomes large, tatha, in the same way, in the last line, daivam. Daiva, the results of your past karmas, sadhu vivardhate. My translation here is lame. Sadhu vivardhate. Daiva vivardhate is to grow. So daiva grows well. Daiva grows strong. The results of your past deeds yield very strong results in this life when karma samayuktaha, when they are combined with your deeds, your actions, your willful effort. The point being made here is you could be born with the best karma a human being could be born with. But then if you just sit on your chair and do nothing, that daiva won't amount to much. Just as this little fire won't do much. By the way, I guess we should make the metaphor more clear. Think about how many people, even today, in villages throughout India and elsewhere, these ladies are cooking with wood and cow dung. So if you're ready to cook dinner, you're going to boil rice, you put some sticks there, and then underneath this you put some fire, and then you have this little flame. How long will it take you to cook your rice? Forget it. That little flame could be on all night and your rice will never get cooked. Which is why you see those ladies doing all of this stuff, and you know, to kindle that fire. Otherwise, there's no dinner. So fire is not enough. That fire has to be fanned if you're going to have dinner tonight. In the same way, being born with good karma is not enough. Without your effort, that karma is going to amount to nothing. You've wasted it. And of course, I think you know that in Hindu scripture, it's said to be born as a human being is extraordinarily good karma. You know, they speak of there being 84 lakh yonis, 8.4 million possible births. You could have been born in so many other ways. You got born as a human being. What is the odds? The odds of being born as a human being, according to that story, is 1 in 8.4 million. Not bad. You have that good karma to be born as a human being. The point is, the fact that you're sitting here is evidence of that good karma. But then, if you fail to work hard in life, because I'm not speaking of you, you've all worked so hard, but one who doesn't work hard in life squanders that human birth. Clear? Human birth is a great blessing. It is squandered if it's not matched with your effort, and that's exactly what it says in the second half. That daivam, the good blessings of being born as a human being, sadhu vivardhate, will yield its complete, full, good results only when karma samayuktam, only when it's accompanied by karma. And here karma has the literal meaning, deed, action. So only when that daiva is accompanied by your hard work, only then will your life be completely fruitful. One more metaphor. Tatha thailakshaya deepaha, yatha thailakshaya deepaha, pramlanim upagacchati, pramlanim upagacchati, tatha karmakshaya devam, tatha karmakshaya pramlanimupagacchati, pramlanimupagacchati. You see, yata tata, same structure. Also in logic, they speak of you first, you give both a positive drishtanta and then a negative one. So the positive one is given, now here comes the negative one. So it's following some logic here. Here, a different example is given. First example was of Agni. Now the example is given of a Deepa. Almost the same, but not quite. Agni is a fire, and in particular, a cooking fire. That was quite an appropriate way of explaining it. Here, Deepa means a lamp. And lamp doesn't mean a fixture with a light bulb in it. In ancient times, there were no light bulbs. So lamp means a wick fed by oil. So that's the metaphor, is deepa, which is a wick, which a burning wick fed by oil. It says that lamp, in a second line, pramlanim upagacchati. Upagacchati, it becomes pramlanim. It goes out. The flame gets extinguished. That's a nice translation. Good, that's my translation. That flame becomes extinguished when tila kshayat. Tila, oil. You know that from till the sesame. So tila is that which comes from till, oil. So when tila kshayat, when that oil gets exhausted, when the oil is consumed, then that flame of the deepa, pramlanim upagacchati, it goes out. When the oil is consumed, the flame goes out. Very familiar metaphor for us all. But what does it represent? That's a metaphor that now we see the darshtanta, tata, in the same way. Daivam pramlanim upagacchati. Daivam, your good karma. Pramlanim upagacchati becomes exhausted, goes away, goes out. Like the lamp goes out. Your good karma goes out. Huh? Goes out how? Karma kshayat, when you stop making effort. It's kind of making the same point as a prior verse, but only in negative terms. When you run out of oil, the lamp goes out. When you stop making an effort in life, whatever good karmas you have will no longer bless you. And they won't bless you because the outcome of a situation is due to both factors. If you remove one factor, then the other factor is useless. You need both. So both of these verses make exactly the same point. And notice again, the emphasis is on Purushakara. And the emphasis is on Purushakara because of this tendency for religious people to say, everything is in God's hands, why should I? What difference does it make if I act or don't act? This is such a harmful misinterpretation of the doctrine of karma, and it's a fairly widespread misinterpretation of the doctrine of karma. And let's speak about this just for a moment. How is it that this misinterpretation is so prevalent? It's like a correct interpretation is almost unknown. Most people cling to this misinterpretation. Everything is in God's hands. I see where this goes. Everything is in God's hands. Whatever will happen is up to God's will. Inshallah. You get the point? That's not Hindu teaching. That's Islamic teaching. And you may have heard me say this before, but the presence of Islam in India for 1400 years has had some consequences. And one of those consequences is some kinds of Islamic thinking has rubbed off on Hindus. And this is a good case in point. So it's very Islamic to say everything is in God's hands. I'll see you tomorrow, inshallah. What connection has that to Hindu teachings? Not at all. But it's pretty obvious how that kind of thinking has insinuated itself into the modern Hindu mind. And pardon me for using strong language, it's a contamination from another religion. And it's not the only contamination. Christianity has been present in India for about 400 years. It's also had similar effects. We won't get into that. That's not our topic here. But the fact is that the presence of Islam and Christianity in India has had some negative consequences. Maybe we can find some positive consequences also. I don't deny that. But these negative consequences are quite clear. So the point we're establishing here is, why is there so much emphasis among Hindus, among too many Hindus, emphasizing daiva and de-emphasizing Purushakara, and this Islamic influence perhaps is one of those reasons. And it is so strong, and just finish with one anecdote here. In the 19th century, Europeans began to travel to India to study its religion and culture. So they began learning Sanskrit, began studying scriptures, began having discussions with the local Hindu pundits and swamis and acharyas, teachers, etc. And it's very interesting that the earliest of those Europeans to study Hinduism, their analysis of the doctrine of karma, the term used by more than several, by the way, they're called Indologists. Indologist refers to those European scholars who went to India to study. And the conclusion of these Indologists is that the doctrine of karma is a very negative, world-negating doctrine. That was their impression. A world-negating doctrine. World-negating why? Nothing I do will make any difference. Everything is already determined by Daiva. That's what it means, world-negating. Negating the efficacy of any worldly action. So the conclusion of these Indologists is that the doctrine of karma is world-negating. Guess what? Their interpretation was wrong because it was based on their discussions with Hindus who didn't understand the doctrine of karma correctly. This is such a typical thing. Hindus, pardon me for going off on a bit of a tangent, but people don't understand their own religions properly. Muslims don't understand Islam. Christians certainly don't understand Christianity. So Islam we have some time. There's only one verse left, so give me the freedom to go off on a tangent here. Islam is the religion of peace and submission, right? Which is why you should kill anyone who's not a Muslim. Huh? Muslims don't understand their own religion. To be a good Christian, you have to convert everyone else. Jesus accepted Jews. There's a wonderful story. He accepted a prostitute. He accepted what we would call an outcast, a Sumerian lady, a lady of a tribe that was very despised. Jesus accepted everyone. He is known for his love and acceptance. Are Christians known for always being so accepting? That's my point. Muslims don't understand Islam. Christians don't understand Christianity, Jesus. Christians, look at the difference. Christians understand Christianity fine. They don't understand Jesus. It's a problem. Big topic. And what I'm leading up to, of course, is Hindus don't understand Hinduism. And that misunderstanding causes problems, as in the other cases. And I'll just give you a funny example of it, then we'll come back to our text. How many Hindus will say, I go to the temple and I worship the idol on the altar? Very common. Hindus go to the temple to worship the idol on the altar. Please look up the word idol in a dictionary. And I think there are many meanings. One of the first meanings is a false god. That's what the word idol means. Yes, I know in India it has a different meaning. We're not in India. In the Western world, the word idol means a false god. When Hindus use that word idol, they're misrepresenting their own religion. Beside the fact that when the Hindu stands in front of the altar, are they worshiping a god who's 4 feet tall? Or are they worshiping the all-pervasive God of the universe? Wow! But please tell me, how many Hindus completely understand that? That when you stand in front of that 4-foot deity, that you're actually worshiping the all-pervasive God of the universe? Hindus themselves don't understand. This is a problem. Of course, that's why we have all these classes. We need to understand properly. When Muslims understand Islam, they become better Muslims. When Christians understand Jesus, not Christianity, when Christians understand Jesus, they become better Christians. And when we understand these teachings better, then we become better Hindus. Okay, enough said. And we come now to the final verse, which has got an interesting twist.
Abhyutthanena daivasya, abhyutthanena daivas samarabdhena karmana, samarabdhena vidhina karmana chaiva, vidhina karmana swargamargamavapnuyat.
So coming at the end of the chapter, summarizing what we've just seen. So the first half, talking about daiva. So see, daivasya, of daiva. What comes from daiva? Prarabdhena karmana. Karma, in particular, prarabdha karma. Most of you know that's a technical term. Prarabdha karma describes those karmas with which you're born, those good and bad results from past lives, which will affect you in this life. According to the doctrine of karma, you've had an infinite number of prior lives, and an infinite number of prior lives you've accumulated an infinite amount of karma, but to exhaust an infinite amount of karma would require an infinitely long life. Therefore, this life is not due to all your karma, what we call sanchitta karma, that infinite accumulation of karma. This particular life is due to a subset, as it were, of your karmas. That subset of karmas, which is going to fructify in this one lifetime, is called prarabdha karma. Prarabdhena karmana. Due to these prarabdha karmas, which are abhyutthanena, which are in the process of fructifying, literally means having, they've arisen. To arise in this context means they're fructifying. So the karmas, daivasya, the portion of karmas that give rise to this life have already begun to fructify. That's that factor called daiva. That's one factor. But now we have another factor, or maybe more than one other factor. Look at the next line. So first half is talking about daiva. Second half begins, vidhina karmana cha eva. So karmana cha, and again, karma, and here it's confusing. Because when we say my karma, mera karm, you're not talking about the results of, you're not talking about your deeds that you're committing right now, but that's literally what karma means.
When you talk about my karma, that's shorthand. You've heard me make this point many times. Shorthand for karma pala. My karma is my karma pala. Here, it's not shorthand. Talking about my karma, my deeds. So, karma na, due to deeds. First half is whatever unfolds in life is due to daiva. Then it says karma na cha, and due to deeds. But we have one more word here. It's a very interesting word. Interesting choice of words. And I think it was done deliberately, because it's a tricky word. Vidhina karmana. Now, can I bore you with 30 seconds of grammar? And the question is vidhi here functioning as an adjective to karma, or is it separate? Which is to say, are we talking about karmas which are vidhi? Vidhi has, like any word, lots of different meanings. By the way, a modern meaning for it, meaning fate or destiny, which is a modern translation of vidhi, we're back to inshallah, right? The moment you translate vidhi as fate or destiny, you're putting an Islamic dress on our Mahabharata. Please don't do that. Okay. Not that there's nothing wrong with Islam, but let's not confuse things here. So vidhi in modern parlance can mean fate or destiny. Can't mean it here because we understand properly. Another important meaning of vidhi is that which is done by vidhata. Kriti is that which is done by karta. Kriti means a deed, is that which is done by karta, an agent of action. In the same way, vidhi is that which is done by vidhata. Vidhata means God, Ishvara. So vidhi is that which is done by God. That's another meaning. And then there's yet another meaning. Did you ever follow a puja vidhi? So there, vidhi means a mode of doing things. Puja vidhi is a mode of action. So now we can start saying, well, which meaning is meant here? So vidhi na karma na cha. So first of all, are we talking about not two factors, but three factors? Factor one, daiva, prarabdha karma. Factor two, karma, purushakara, your efforts. Factor three, vidhi, fate. No, cross that one off. We're back to inshallah. Another interpretation, vidhi na karma na, take it as an adjective, and it means karma's done in a certain manner. That's a perfectly fine meaning. So now we're back to two factors. One factor is prarabdha karma, daiva. Second is vidhina karmana, actions done according to vidhi, according to a certain mode. So that's our conventional meaning, and that's what we've been discussing throughout this chapter. I wasn't sure if that's what it meant, so I went and looked in the commentary. The commentary on all of this. And the commentator says, yep, that's what it means. He didn't say, yeah, that's what it means, but you get my point. The commentator's explanation conformed with whatever we're discussing so far. I saw another meaning. I'm not saying the commentator is wrong, because the commentator is a great scholar. But there's another way of interpreting it, and I've already said, vidhi is that which is done by vidhata. That which is done by vidhata, that which comes from Ishvara. And many of you were in the meditation session when I asked, is there a third factor? So the farmer has a bunch of seeds. The farmer has land. The farmer plants all those seeds and irrigates the land. Is there anything else the farmer can do to ensure that he has good crops? I said there's a third thing he can do, and that is prayer. So prayer is a third thing in addition to your daiva, in addition to tilling the field. Prayer indeed is a third thing he can do. Is it a third factor? We talked about this in the meditation session. It's a third thing he can do. It's not a third factor because prayer is purushakara. Prayer is an act you perform. Whether it is a physical act like doing puja, whether it is an oral act like saying a prayer, whether it is a mental act like some kind of meditation, prayer is a karma, prayer is a deed. So it doesn't qualify as a third factor. It's included in the second one. But in terms of the metaphor, it's definitely a third thing that can be done. The farmer has seeds. The farmer plants the seeds, karma. The farmer tills his land, karma. The farmer irrigates the land, karma. But the farmer can also pray. Prayer is a karma, but it certainly is a different kind of karma compared to tilling the land and irrigating it. So this is another way of interpreting this verse. And it points to a third thing, not a third factor, but a third thing, sorry for my informal language, and that is prayer. So now if we identify all three, first half, due to your prarabdha karma, and then in this line, karmana cha, and due to your efforts, purushakara, vidhina cha, and due to the grace you earn through prayer, due to all three of these, this is my interpretation, a little different from the commentator, but still consistent. Due to all three of these, what is the outcome? Apnuyat, you will gain swarga margam, the path to heaven. Through all three of these factors, you will gain the path to heaven, means the path to whatever you want in life, to happiness, contentment, and peace. Swarga here is not so specific, it's more metaphoric. But notice how we can interpret this to bring in a third, not a unique third factor, but a third element to recognize, and that is, in addition to daiva, the good karmas we're born with, in addition to purushakara, the efforts that we make in this life, there is a third, not a third factor, since it's a karma, but a third thing we can fall back on, and that is prayer. Prayer is a karma. Prayer is purushakara, but prayer is unique in that it invokes God's grace. We earn God's grace. We invoke God's grace, as I explained in the meditation session. And that is another, not a third factor, but a third element that can bless us in life. And with that verse, we come to the end of this chapter. Next time, we'll take up the next part of the Anushasana Parva. Couple of important announcements. Once in a month, we have an advanced meditation session. I'll be conducting that tomorrow at 6 p.m. If you're already a meditator and want to go more deeply, please join us for advanced meditation tomorrow at 6 p.m. Next Saturday, we're going to have our celebration of Ganesha Chaturthi. We like to celebrate on the weekends. So next Saturday, please come at 11 o'clock. We start with some puja, some chanting. I'll have a nice discourse to share with you. We'll conclude with arati and prasad. If you're coming, you can bring a dish of food, sign up on the counter. Oh, here's one more thing to mention to you. I just finished a new video. I've been posting these videos. By the way, these videos turn out to be a good form of outreach. The videos I've posted on YouTube collectively have almost 1 million views.
Just to show the effect of, by the way, if you go and listen, if you go and watch those videos, you might be the 1 millionth. You won't get a prize, but almost 1 million, so you can go and... Anyway, good outreach. I'm just bringing this to your attention. That I just posted a new video on Manisha Panchakam. We just chanted it last week. And it has a very interesting orientation. It deals with the problem of racism and casteism. Since some of you know the back story to Manisha Panchakam, Shankara meets the Chandala, the outcast in Varanasi. If you don't know the back story, you should definitely go and see that video. So it's posted. You can just go to YouTube and look for my name and Manisha Panchakam. It's on our website as well. I think you'll enjoy it. And you'll be our 1 millionth viewer. It'll be nice. Library will be open after class, and we'll conclude with our prayers.